Welcome. We'll open the hearing now. I will recognize the hearing of the Subcommittee on Courts, Internet, and Intellectual Property will come to order. I'll recognize myself for an opening statement. I would be remiss to begin any music licensing hearing without acknowledging that reforming Section 115 may not be the top priority of many in this room. After all, small webcasters are scrambling to assess the viability of their current business models after the recent rate determination by the Copyright Royalty Board. In addition, the recent announcement of the XM Sirius merger has exposed the glaring inequities of the Copyright Act and its application to different technologies, internet, cable, satellite, and of course, the over-the-air broadcasters. This raises the question, should I and interested colleagues reintroduce a version of the Perform Act? And is it finally time for a performance right to extend to terrestrial radio? These developments highlight a quintessential issue for the subcommittee. Should we proceed with comprehensive reform of music licensing or deal with it in a piecemeal fashion? For the sake of this hearing, the subcommittee will limit its focus to Section 115. Many times over the past several years, this subcommittee has explored the need for reforming the Section 115 compulsory license for musical works. All interested parties agree that it is broken and that the licensing structure that was developed to deal with the distribution of piano rolls, while updated, still does not provide a fluid mechanism for a new physical and digital music delivery models. Complaints about Section 115 range from its administrative burdens relating to the complexities of the notice requirements to the legal ambiguities relating to the definition of digital phonorecord delivery, DPD, or more broadly, where or if a performance ends and reproduction begins. However, no consensus exists for how to fix Section 115. At the macro level, parties agree that rampant piracy over peer-to-peer networks creates a dire need to address digital music licensing reform. In 2005 alone, nearly 20 billion illegal file swaps and downloads occurred. This piracy harms an industry that provides jobs in my district and throughout the country, and it hurts all the parties involved, from the songwriter to the recording artist and to all the businesses that service the industry. In a post-Grokster environment, we have a unique opportunity to channel consumers away from illegal P2P networks towards legitimate online music distribution services. But the window is closing. In 2006, digital music sales totaled $2 billion, up from $1.1 billion in 2005. Consumers downloaded an estimated 795 million songs, up 89% from the 2005 figures. Currently, there are 4 million tracks available for downloading, facilitated by 500 online music services available in over 40 countries. Further fueling the growth of digital downloads, portable music player sales increased 43% to $120 million in 2006. In addition, ringtones, once dismissed as nothing more than a passing fad, have become a $3 billion worldwide market. This is all good news. However, despite their meteoric growth, legal online music services still represent the equivalent of a fly on the back of the online piracy elephant. Yesterday's Wall Street Journal described how digital music has failed to compensate for lost sales of CDs and that, according to Big Champagne, 1 billion songs a month are traded on illegal file sharing networks. I'll let you figure out what Big Champagne is. Therefore, since there is broad consensus that inefficiencies in Section 115 hinder the rollout of new legal music offerings, we must turn our focus to the question of how to reform Section 115. I fear that if we do not address particular reforms to Section 115 soon, legitimate music services will not be able to compete with free or provide consumers with their choice of music anytime, any place, and in any format, while at the same time ensuring that creators receive adequate compensation. There have been multiple suggestions for reforming the compulsory license, including one, designating an agent to collectively manage reproduction and redistribution rights, two, collectively licensing performance, distribution, and reproduction rights through a music rights organization, three, amending 115 to ease just the administrative burden and legal uncertainty, and four, repealing Section 115 and allowing the marketplace to regulate licensing. Last year, the former chairman of this subcommittee, Congressman Lamar Smith, made a valiant effort to resolve the issue. Perhaps back then, the interested parties lacked the motivation to act. Clearly, all parties would benefit from Section 115 reform. For example, the business survival of the Digital Media Association members depends on the success of legitimate online music services. In addition, the proliferation of additional legal music offerings will provide vital new sources of royalties for members of the National Music Publishers Association and songwriters. Finally, RIA members will also benefit through the distribution of their works in secure new formats. Since the subcommittee last met on this issue, there have been several developments. First, the Copyright Office determined that ringtones fall within the scope of the 115 license, though the determination is on appeal. Also, ASCAP and Digital Music Services are facing off in federal court in New York over whether a download of a musical work implicates a public performance, and copyright royalty judges are about to set a discovery schedule in the Section 115 rate proceeding. I don't deny that several obstacles seem to remain in the way of full-scale realization of music distribution possibilities. Whatever the outcome of the reforms we ultimately adopt, our focus needs to remain on facilitating the licensing of distribution and reproduction rights so that consumers can receive music in the manner they want, while at the same time providing rightful compensation to the creators of music. Rewards for innovation are hard enough to come by for the songwriters who are often the first to create, but last to be paid. I look forward today to hearing from our witness, Mary Beth Peters, and would now recognize our distinguished ranking minority member, my friend Howard Coble, for his opening statement.
Yes, you pressed it. Oh, you dropped that. You dropped that pencil. Thank you. Yeah. But thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, as you know, because of term limits, I was removed from this subcommittee for the past 4 years. It is indeed good to see old friends in the room today, including the distinguished register and her able staff, who is covering her back as we speak. Mr. Chairman, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution grants Congress this power to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. In 1909, the 61st Congress decided to exercise this power by enacting a compulsory license that authorized anyone to reproduce and distribute piano rolls for use in the home entertainment centers of their day, player pianos, providing they paid a royalty of 2 cents to the owner of the copyright in the musical work, which typically was the songwriter or a music publisher. The antecedent of Section 115 of the Copyright Act, which is the subject of our hearing today, this license was intended to balance the interest of copyright owners in controlling and receiving compensation from the use of their writings and the interests of consumers and music distributors who wanted to make available the widest variety of musical compositions at the lowest cost to the public. The development of new technologies and mediums for the physical distribution of music, such as phonographic records and cassette tapes, as well as a recognition of the woefully inadequate compensation provided to copyright owners by the 2 cent statutory royalty, led to amendments to the law in 1976. In 1995, the Congress again revisited the license by enacting the Digital Performance Right in Sound Recordings Act, or DPRA. At that time, Congress sought to anticipate the transition from the physical distribution of products such as albums, CDs, and tapes that contain music to the digital delivery of music files via computer and the internet by making clear that copyright owners were to benefit from the payment of royalties for digital deliveries of photocords. Notwithstanding these amendments, there is substantial evidence that Section 115 is, in the words of our distinguished registrar, Ms. Peters, dysfunctional. The Copyright Office reports that the license appears to be seldom used by licensees. The administration of the license is fraught with inefficiencies, ambiguities, and difficulties, and recommends the license needs to be structurally changed and amended to clarify which licensees are required for the transmission of music if Congress is to improve its operation. Indeed, the view that the license is dysfunctional is widely shared by those in the music publishing, reproduction, and distribution industries. It is furthermore the opinion of the present and former leaders of this subcommittee who worked diligently and introduced Section 115 Reform Act of 2006, which is commonly referred to as CERA. Though marked up by the subcommittee last June, you will recall, Mr. Chairman, several outstanding issues conspired to prevent that measure from being formally enacted prior to the adjournment of the Congress for that year. I believe the members of this subcommittee and the parties interested in modernizing the music license systems owe a debt and gratitude to our former chairman, Representative Smith, the distinguished gentleman from Texas, and the current chairman, Representative Berman, the distinguished gentleman from California, for their commitment and leadership in seeking to change or to make Section 115 relevant in the age of digital music. Finally, while there is an amen chorus that the license is broken and requires repair, the composers, music publishers, record companies, digital distributors, and consumers, who all have a legitimate stake in rebalancing Section 115, all sing different tunes about how precisely it should be accomplished. The process that led to the introduction and markup of Section 115 Reform Act brought many of these parties closer together. I look forward to hearing the testimony from Ms. Peters today, Mr. Chairman, as you indicated, and to learning more about proposals to clarify the rights that need to be licensed, as well as approaches for streamlining the rights approval process. This concludes my remark, and I thank the chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Coble. Chairman Conyers?
After these two great descriptions of what we're here for, I'll put my statement in the record.
This is really a three-witness hearing of Mary Beth Peters, the registrar, Mr. Coble, and myself. The ranking member of the committee, Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chairman, I do have an opening statement I'd like to make.
Yes, you're recognized.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, first of all, I appreciated your comments a while ago about our efforts last year, and of course I hope those efforts will lead to results sometime soon this year. Mr. Chairman, thank you for convening this hearing on Section 115 of the Copyright Act and the status of proposals to adapt it to the realities of today's digital marketplace. Last June, this subcommittee began the process of bringing the law that governs the music industry, a multi-billion dollar enterprise, into the digital age with the introduction and markup of Section 115 Reform Act of 2006, or CERA. Prior to the introduction of CERA, the subcommittee had conducted seven hearings over the past two Congresses on aspects of the copyright law that relate to music licensing and digital technology. CERA was introduced to focus attention on the need to modernize the mechanical license that governs the making and distribution of phono records in the U.S. The need for a comprehensive rewrite of this compulsory license has been apparent for some time. Imperfect, and in many ways anachronistic, the license is nevertheless one that has generally been accepted by those who have been engaged in composing, publishing, or producing phono records for many years. In its current form, though, the license fails to adequately encourage the cultivation and development of a robust, legitimate online digital music market, something that is necessary for the future health of composers, publishers, record companies, recording artists, and consumers. The development of a legal marketplace will improve the consumer experience by enabling music lovers to purchase and enjoy music when and where they want. Tens of millions of American consumers already embrace technologies that enable them to enjoy music in new, exciting, and previously unimaginable ways. As the number and variety of online music services expands, Congress has a responsibility to ensure the law is modernized in a manner that strikes the appropriate balance between the rights of copyright owners, the economic necessities of the marketplace, and the interest of consumers. SIRA was an important first step in beginning this process. The requirement to update our nation's music licensing laws grows more urgent every day. Now, Mr. Chairman, as you noted a while ago, proof of this statement was on the front page of yesterday's Wall Street Journal, which published an article that described a, quote, seismic shift in the way consumers acquire music, and stated overall, quote, sales of all music, digital and physical, are down 10% this year, and that CD sales have plunged a startling 20% over the last year. To be sure, there are a number of factors that have contributed to this dramatic decline. However, Congress and the music industry have the power to advance the adoption of a modern, sensible, and efficient music licensing system that rewards creators and facilitates the ability of legitimate licensees to acquire the legal rights that they need to reproduce, distribute, and perform music. I'm encouraged that we have the opportunity to build on SIRA's foundation and hopefully succeed in enacting a bipartisan measure that updates and reforms our nation's music licensing laws. The critical question that will need to be addressed by the music industry this Congress is whether it will find common ground and take the steps necessary for the development of a 21st century music licensing system. In closing, Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you and the ranking member of the subcommittee for your recognition of the importance of this issue and the decision to schedule this oversight hearing so early in the congressional session. Mr. Chairman, I ask unanimous consent that the Wall Street Journal article that you and I referred to be made a part of the record.
Generally.
And furthermore, Mr. Chairman, I want to apologize for having to leave almost immediately in order to get to the House floor. As you know, the Judiciary Committee has a bill that's coming up, and I need to tend to that. But I know this is going to be an interesting hearing, and I look forward to reading Mary Beth's testimony and to learning more about the subject. And I'll yield back the balance of my time.
See, in the old days, we wouldn't have been able to continue while a judiciary bill was going on the House floor. Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. Do any other members wish to make opening statements? Or can okay, then I will introduce our witness. No one to anybody who's been around here a while. She is Mary Beth Peters, the Register of Copyrights. Ms. Peters has been registered since 1994. Previously, she served as the policy planning advisor to the former Register. In addition to her leadership of the Copyright Office, Ms. Peters serves on the Intellectual Property Advisory Committees of several law schools and is a member of the Board of Trustees of the Copyright Society of the United States of America. Ms. Peters received her undergraduate degree from Rhode Island College and her law degree from George Washington University. She is not both, she is not simply important as because of her position, but she is truly an expert on this subject. Ms. Peters, it's good to have you here again. Your written statement will be part of the record in its entirety, and would appreciate you being able to summarize your testimony in around 5 minutes, and we welcome you. Please begin.
Start by saying, Chairman Berman, Ranking Member Koval, and members of the subcommittee, thank you for inviting me to testify on reforming the compulsory license dealing with the reproduction and distribution of non-dramatic musical works by means of physical phono records and digital phono record deliveries, Section 115 of the Copyright Act, a topic that has been on the subcommittee's agenda and my office's agenda for more than 3 years. During this period, I've testified 4 times, 3 of them before this subcommittee. And I am going to use the same word that you use, Mr. Berman, that there have been valiant efforts by you and Mr. Smith and by the subcommittee staff over the past 3 years, valiant efforts by the parties, and even by my office, to reach consensus on reform. Yes, we were close, but at the end of the day, legislation was not enacted. Today, my message is the situation is worse, new issues are arising, and the likelihood of reaching consensus has lessened considerably. Yet, reform of Section 115 is urgent. So my focus today is on what potentially is achievable. Now, over the past 3 years, I've offered a number of solutions. At different times, different solutions. My preferred solution has always been abolition of the license. However, I am not advocating abolishing the license today. That would bring chaos. So whatever we do for reform needs to be achievable, and we can look at maybe the reform as transitional if, in fact, the goal ultimately, you agree, is to get rid of the license. Before going on, let me give you a little bit of background, and you both referred to it, and Mr. Coble, Mr. Berman, in your opening remarks. In 1995, the compulsory license was amended in anticipation of the introduction of digital music services. It was expanded to cover digital phonorecord deliveries. However, no one anticipated what would come. No one anticipated peer-to-peer, Napster, and the like. Nor could they foresee the issues that such technologies would raise. The Copyright Office, through its regulatory powers, has updated its regulations in response to industry petitions to make it work better, and we may continue to do so. But regulatory action won't solve the problems. Substantive legislative reform is needed. I want to highlight two possible solutions. First, it could be wholesale sublicensing with a safe harbor provision for sublicensors, or an amendment to Section 115 to mirror the blanket compulsory license in Section 114, which is the section which deals with digital performances of sound recordings. Under either option, however, the issue of clarifying the rights is essential. More about rights later. Let me start with sublicensing, which exists today in the marketplace. Online music companies can go to one entity, typically the record label, and receive all of the rights they need to operate a music service. Sublicensing works, and with the addition of minimal statutory changes, could work even better. I don't expect that every party will endorse additional sublicensing provisions, but this approach would solve the problem. Sublicensing makes sense from a practical perspective because music services already have to deal with the record labels. So long as the record label passes on the proper royalty amount to the publisher that they have collected and the music services get the rights they need and money flows back in a timely fashion, then parties will get the benefit of the compulsory license. The second legislative option is to adopt the 114 model in Section 115. This would require greater changes in the law, but much of the language to create a 115 license already exists in 114. Under the 114 framework today, one entity with respect to webcasters, Sound Exchange, collects all the royalty income on behalf of all rights holders and then distributes that money to them. It's an efficient system that both licensees and licensors support, despite the outcry over the recent rate decision. It's not necessarily over the process per se, it's the rate. As I've noted earlier, solving the rights issues is really necessary. And the question here is, what's the problem with the rights? Licensing is divided into two separate markets. One is public performance. One is reproductions and distributions. This pits two different middlemen for the same copyright owner against each other. Each wants and each demands a piece of the action, whatever that action might be. But whether or not two or more separate rights are truly indicated and deserving of compensation, is a question that is before a variety of bodies at this point. But on top of whether or not they're truly implicated, There is the belief that it is inefficient to require a licensee to seek out two separate licenses from two separate sources in order to compensate the same copyright owner for the right to engage in a single transmission of a single work. So clarification of what rights are implicated and whether those rights have liability is critical. If the goal, and I think this is the goal, is to shift users away from piratical services to legitimate services, we must have a statutory framework that enables music services to flourish. As I think all of us who have spoken this morning have said, the current framework for online services isn't just outdated, it's broken. It needs to be fixed. I look forward to working with all of you in trying to figure out a solution that will work for the digital marketplace, that will compensate songwriters, will compensate publishers. The key is not to deny rights holders the ability to get a fair bargain. It's really to enable the music services so money will flow back. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll recognize myself for 5 minutes for some questions, and we'll move ahead. I know the Copyright Office expressed unease about last year's bill. So if Congress were to pursue legislation similar to CIRA, what policy considerations should we be concerned with?
I think we went on record with some of our concerns, and I'll just outline one of them. One of them, actually, I think, is solvable. I think we actually even came forward with a way to do it. And it really deals with streaming, and specifically whether or not, when streams are involved, there is, in fact, a distribution of a phono record. We believe that, especially on-demand streams, could well substitute for the sale of a phono record, and therefore the value of an on-demand stream is higher than pure streaming. So we agree that that is a compensable act that really has a high value. Our disagreement was calling it a distribution of a phono record. For us, it really was a public performance. So the issue wasn't, it was more about terminology. And I think that that's fixable. There were some other issues that dealt with the administration of the license that get into the nitty-gritty of a designated agent and what the transparency of that organization is and how it runs. And we can give you further details if you want.
So basically what you're saying really is some of it's a debate. It's not a fight about so much. I mean, there will be differences of opinion about compensation, but it's a fight about how you analyze and the terminology used to describe it.
Well, our concern was the way that it was described in that bill.
Right.
My issue about rights clarification, I think, has ratcheted up a little bit since CIRA basically was on the table. I think the proceeding in the rate court in the Southern District of New York with regard to whether or not performances, compensatable performances, are involved in downloads is a big issue right now.
Yeah. One of the webcaster's concerns in the context of Section 115 reform is how to treat ephemeral recordings used to facilitate the transmission of music. Here's what's been cited as your position on this issue. Footnote.
You're talking about a footnote.
434. 434. But I'm only going to read part of it here. As we indicated in 1998 to the affected parties, we saw no justification for the disparate treatment of broadcasters and webcasters regarding the making of ephemeral recordings. nor did we see any justification for the imposition of a royalty obligation under a statutory license to make copies that have no independent economic value and are made solely to enable another use that is permitted under a separate compulsory license. There's a lot of controversy about this footnote. What did the office mean to say in footnote 434 of your
as opposed to what we did.
104 report? Maybe I beat Mr. Boucher to this question. I don't know.
When we were doing what's known as the 104 report, we were looking at various exemptions. And it really, this issue came up with respect to the fact that section 112A basically gave broadcasters a free ride. And so it came up in the context of 112A. And then what we basically said is, in principle, we believe that people who perform like activities should be treated essentially the same way. And because the focus was on, well, you shouldn't have to pay at all, we basically said, to make them equal, then maybe they shouldn't have to pay at all. However, what you really need to step back and say is, what is the value of those ephemeral copies? And it may be that there is value and you flip it the other way. But our main point, and I agree we took a position that said don't pay at all. Basically make E, which deals with webcasting and sound recordings, the equivalent of A, which deals with broadcasters and no liability, the same. I'm here today to basically say, I can see the arguments with regard to server copies in some instances, and so the issue is one of value. If there's value, and it should be licensed, there should be payment. But whoever is involved should be treated exactly the same way. Don't have disparity.
I will restrain myself from getting into the issue of the free ride for broadcasters, and I will...
So will I.
This is a 115 hearing, and I will recognize my the ranking member, Mr. Coble, for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Peters, has been said, good to have you with us this morning. Ms. Peters, the goal of the music industry is to increase its revenue at a time when sales of CDs are falling and consumers are choosing to acquire music by other means. Some might even believe that we're attempting to swim upstream against the tide here, but let me ask you this. Do you think that success in reforming Section 115 will actually result in reversing these trends and growing the pie for those involved in creating, producing, and distributing music?
I believe that reform will help. Ultimately, it's the consuming public that makes the decision in the marketplace. But I do believe that the more legitimate services that you have, and that means enabling the digital music services to have as much music as possible to make available to consumers, moves us in the right direction. It's very difficult to compete against free. A second part of all of this is the consumer, and we have to do a better job of explaining why promoting creativity, promoting songwriters, promoting not only the people who write the songs, but the people who bring the songs to us, that has to be appreciated. So it's kind of a dual track, but this is certainly the first step.
Let me put a simplified question to you that may not involve a simplified answer. What do you consider to be the chief obstacle or impediment to reform, A, and B, how do we overcome it?
The chief obstacle, in my view, is there are at least three major parties involved, all of whom have their own, and I understand it, issues and way they want to see it this resolved. And trying to reach consensus isn't going to happen because their own interests differ significantly. So it really is, I think, Congress's responsibility to step back and say, what is the best balance? You cited the Constitution. What encourages creativity the most and distribution of product for the benefit of the American people? And I think there's some hard choices that you have to make. You're going to have to decide on what the path is and what the fair balance is. Obviously, if the answer were easy, we would have solved it 3 years ago. People in my office will smile. We've been meeting with various parties saying what the situation is and where are you going. And I did a reaction the other day and I went, I threw up my arms. I said, I don't know what to do. This is so complicated. So it is a difficult, but choose a path. Choose a 114 blanket license, but choose the path and then keep that path narrow to accomplish ease of administration of the mechanical compulsory license so that digital music services can bring the largest amount of content to the people so that they can compete with free unauthorized services.
Well, it's easy to propound a simple question, and I think you responded as well as you could. I thank you for that. Ms. Peters, given that the 115 license is seldom used, that technology is moving faster than the legislative process, and that industry stakeholders have been unable or unwilling to agree on one comprehensive reform proposal, should our committee consider simply sunsetting the license, just as the distant signal satellite license, the 119 license, expires every 5 years, unless expressly reauthorized by the Congress? What say you to that?
If what you're saying is leave the license as it is and sunset it, I don't think it works. The problem is now you've got to enable music services now. You've got to figure out how to keep services in business and let them expand and grow to serve consumers' need. So you can't leave it as it is. Actually, I was suggesting that if you fix it and do a short-term fix, then sunset it. But I don't think a solution is leave it as it is and in 5 years sunset it. And I support sunsetting it, but the experience with sunsets hasn't been good. They don't go away.
And I see our red light. I see Mr. Berman's looking at me, so I yield back.
So basically, you're saying we're going to have to make tough decisions?
I'm saying that I think the time has come.
I hate when that happens.
So do I.
Although I don't know, the sunset means we have to make tough decisions over and over again.
That's exactly right.
Since I don't know exactly where people came in, I'm just going to go in the order of seniority, and I recognize the gentleman from Virginia, Mr. Boucher.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. And Ms. Peters, welcome back to the subcommittee.
Thank you.
We enjoy your biannual, if not annual, appearances here. I think that we all agree on the urgent need for Section 115 reform, and you have certainly well stated that in your opening statement, and I thank you for that carefully prepared presentation. Last year, unfortunately, as we sought to process that reform, we had a consensus that was pretty close on most of the key provisions, as you also indicated in your statement. But then at the last minute, as the measure came to the subcommittee for final consideration, there were added some extraneous and very controversial provisions, namely provisions that would have disabled the portable device that XM Satellite Radio is beginning to market, and also a provision that would, as I recall, have added a digital audio broadcast flag. That latter provision is not mature and, frankly, has not been through the same kind of vetting process that the video broadcast flag went through with an independent group comprised of various stakeholder engineers making sure the standard was workable and efficient. That hasn't happened for the audio flag. And for the audio flag, it may not be necessary for Congress to act at all, because one company essentially controls the intellectual property, Ubiquiti, that is being used by the digital radio broadcasters. So, I mean, with an agreement with that company and all the external stakeholders, it could be implemented without Congress even having to act. All of that aside, my question to you is this. I very much hope that in the interest of getting an effective Section 115 reform passed in this Congress, that all of those who might be tempted to burden this bill with these extraneous and controversial provisions or other matters that would be controversial and might weigh it down would refrain from doing so. Because if we pass a Section 115 reform, everybody who has a copyright interest is going to benefit. The labels benefit, the performers benefit, the songwriters and publishers benefit. And I think that Wall Street Journal article that Congressman Smith presented, which I also read yesterday, makes the case as clearly as any of us possibly can, that the lawful distribution by streams and downloads of music on the Internet has got to be made more feasible, and the legal underbrush that is causing that system, as you said, to be broken simply has got to be cleared away. We can do that pretty effectively with the 115 reform. So the first question I have for you is, do you have any comment on the appropriateness of let's don't burden this reform with some of these extraneous and controversial provisions that are really not necessary to reforming Section 115?
The answer is yes, don't burden with extraneous. I guess the issue is what's extraneous and what's, you know, what really is critical. And we may have some disagreement on some of that, but no. Well,
we don't need an audio flag for HD radio.
No, I agree. We don't.
And we don't need to disable the portable devices that XM is putting out to do this, do we?
Not through 115, but
thank
the question
you. That pretty well answered.
That's
a great answer.
The question is, what is 115 going to cover? Activity is either an infringement or it isn't. 115 should focus on what kind of activity you want to promote through a compulsory license.
All right, let's leave it with that. Now, my second question is this. I actually like that footnote a lot, and I'm very familiar with that footnote, and I think you clearly got it right when you said that these incidental copies, the buffer copies, the cache copies, the ephemeral copies that are necessary in order to effectuate a transmission that itself is licensed, really have no independent value. You can't sell these for anything. They are only essentially made in the marketing of something for which copyright royalties are paid under another license. And so why not say that these items simply do not have independent value? It's hard for me to imagine that they do. And I'm frankly a little bit surprised this morning to hear you suggest that maybe they do after all and that your footnote was not properly stated. So tell me this, how can they possibly have independent value when all they do is effectuate a transmission that itself is licensed?
I'm not a guru in the marketplace. I stand by the statement with regard to incidental temporary copies. The question that has come up and where we actually have seen deals, we've seen contracts, where there is separate money for a server copy, just raises for me a question on whether or not there is value.
Well, Ms. Peters, is it possible those deals were made because of the legal uncertainty with regard to whether or not this would be termed to be a copy unless we clearly declare that they have no independent value? I think the answer is yes.
It could be. I'm
Thank you very
I don't
much.
Know the answer to that
Thank
question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
I recognize the gentleman from Florida, Mr. Feeney.
Well, thank you, and thanks for your testimony. My colleague answered questions and asked questions and answered them for you, but I'm a little new to this issue, so I'm going to ask you for some advice. This is one of those areas where Congress tries to regulate a industry that technology is changing so dramatically that legislation is obsolete before it's effective. And would we be better off given that state of things? I mean, nobody could have predicted 15 years ago, or for that matter, five, the status of BlackBerries or iPods or downloading music or on our computers. And given that we can assume that nobody can predict 5 or 15 years from now what the technological opportunities for consumers will be, would we be better off, for example, going to a principles-based set of standards and letting the courts figure it out? Another alternative would be, throughout states in this country, we regulate utilities, for example, electric, water, sewer. Could we create a utility-type regulator of experts that would meet, if necessary, 5 days a week, 4 weeks a month, to settle some of these issues that are rapidly would either of those be a better alternative than Congress trying to anticipate market technology changes?
Let me start with the second. I would hate to see creative product treated as a utility. I would hate to see a song or motion picture or a piece of artwork treated as a utility. So I'm not going to go down that road. I would not suggest that. I think these are efforts of some of the most talented people in the United States and throughout the world, and each one is different and each one has value. It is true that some of the difficulties that we have had with the law is when you use language that is very specific, sometimes to create certainty at a particular moment in time, that language doesn't transition well towards change. And it is true that adopting basic principles whereby things like if in fact a copy is made only to enable a licensed performance, then basically there should not be liability. That kind of a principle can adapt with change. And in fact, in compulsory licenses with regard to rate settings and terms, there already is a structure, a copyright royalty judge structure, and those people are equipped to deal with what's, the services that are in the license and to set rates and terms. So I think that is a better way to go. Just stay away to copyright is a utility.
Well, I didn't mean to regulate
the
quality, but then in terms of the...
I know. I've heard that many times, that everybody treats music like a utility.
The Securities Exchange Commission for 80 years in this country has regulated corporate governance, and without any serious long-term impact on freedom or capitalism or creativity, although we have some minor problems now and then, that's a different committee. You mentioned in your testimony the suggestion that we might create a music rights organization to combine both the mechanical and the performance rights, and you mentioned the benefits of one-stop shopping. But there are some potential harms with this approach, too, and would you elaborate on what the downside or adverse consequences?
I mean, the truth of the matter is that was a proposal that we, the Copyright Office, put forward. There was a hearing on that proposal where I was the only witness, and I can say that there was no support from anyone on that proposal. The downside is the reality of today's world, the reality that the way that music has traditionally been licensed has different organizations that do that, and they are well established. And the thought of basically combining rights and having one organization handle both is not a welcome thought to those organizations.
And finally, well, I see my, I'll yield back to balance the time.
I thank the gentleman, from Florida, Mr. Wexler.
Mr. Chairman, I just got here after the...
Okay, the back problem is I wasn't keeping track of when people got here.
Yeah, deferred whoever was here before.
Okay, then Mr. Watt, the gentleman from North Carolina.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your testimony. I'm new to the subcommittee, but we never got a shot at this issue the last time in the full committee. So I have two questions that I would like to get your responses to. It sounds like you're very, very close to an agreement, at least that would have solved some of these issues in the last term of Congress.
I would say you were close to an agreement. It was Congress, not us.
Then I will rephrase it to
yeah,
say
no, no, no.
It sounds like we were
you
close
were, you were. Yes.
to
okay.
an agreement yes. in, or they were close in
right.
the subcommittee.
Yes. Yes.
To an agreement that would have resolved this. What changes in the marketplace have taken place since that near agreement that need to be taken into account, if any? And what you, I think, indicated in your testimony that you perceive that it is more difficult to do it now than it was then. What are the things that make it more difficult from your perspective, and how might we work through those? And then finally, what advice would you give a new member of this subcommittee about what role he might play in advancing this process to inclusion?
That's quite a question. Let me start with...
Go along with the chairman's a good answer.
other than just...
You have your answer. Okay. Your chairman has spoken.
Sounds like I even need
I'm just
to,
kidding. I'm just
need
kidding.
To follow the chairman.
I'm just kidding.
Or follow about
I'm teasing.
Right?
I'm teasing.
Neither one of those seems like a real good choice to me. No.
That's amazing. All right. Let me start
I can understand
with,
why.
You know, what's changed? I'm not sure what we heard basically is our new business models that bring about a necessity to adjust the road that I basically suggest we go down, a blanket license or sub-licensing. We heard that increasingly it's the compulsory license kicks in after a copyright owner has authorized, so the copyright owner is in the driver's seat for the very first recording of a song.
Was the sub-licensing that you're talking about in the last legislation?
It's actually in the 1995 legislation. But what this compulsory license kicks in is after there actually has been...
You're talking to me about something. Let me
okay.
Let me go back and maybe frame the
okay.
question. If we were starting exactly where we left off the last time, not new things, what are the market changes that would create impediments to moving to conclusion, the changes that have taken place, and what changes would you make from that basic structure?
I don't think it's a marketplace change per se, but it's organizations who are dealing with the marketplace who believe that that existing marketplace is causing new difficulties in the licensing. What I was getting at was this license never dealt with the first recording of a song, and now we're hearing that, you know, we really need to solve the problem of the first recording of a song. We've heard that although the law essentially allows one owner to license for all owners, that the practice is not to do that in the music area, and that each owner is now only authorizing their piece. So the question is, how many owners are there? And in the past, there may have been two, maybe three. We heard 17. When you get 17 owners and each one has to license the piece, if that's the trend, that makes it more difficult. So it's those kinds of things. It's really how the players are now dealing with transactions that are causing some of the strains. And I don't have advice on how you deal with it, other than to say that if you were dealing with two owners and now you're dealing with 17, it's more complicated. If you were dealing with subsequent recordings and now the issue is the initial one, it's a much bigger issue for a compulsory license.
The gentleman's time has expired. The gentleman from Utah, Mr. Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and welcome back to the committee, Ms. Peters. You are with, I don't want to be offensive to anybody else who's appeared before this or any other committee that I serve on, but you're my favorite witness. And it's amazing to me that you know so much, you have such breadth and depth on this subject. I apologize that I've been in and out and doing other things. And this has been asked, I think, perhaps in other ways, but I you've been quoted historically as saying that getting rid of the compulsory license would cause chaos in the industry. Could that be done with a phase out, a 6 month or a 1 year phase out, and does that make sense to do?
I'm not the best person to answer that question. It really
you should leave that judgment up to us.
Well, no, it's the
about your qualifications because you've already made it.
Although we have said that the compulsory license is rarely used, that doesn't mean that it really doesn't form the backdrop of licensing activities. So when you take that backdrop away, what happens? And I have heard from the parties that it would create increased chaos. But I think that that's an area that you certainly could raise with the affected parties.
There are technologies out there that are emerging that would do a great deal more than what we're actually currently doing in practice. We have a bunch of high-tech companies that are, among other things, using music for things that music has never been used for, and therefore it's hard to say what the purpose would be or how to charge that. So, for instance, if a company allows or creates tools for a family to put together a family album, and that family may be five kids and two parents and grandparents and ultimately grandkids and great-grandkids, you could, in Utah, that could actually be quite a number.
Yes.
With everybody having a copy, the question is, how do you license that? And currently, that's I'm thinking of a particular company that does this, and if they had to license every song that they use, in fact, that's what they've been doing, and they're very frustrated because they don't. They're in a world where there's no model, traditional model for licensing, and so they have to negotiate them, and they're negotiating in the context of a model that nobody understands the scope of. Whereas I think that
that's the issue.
Right. So do we help solve that issue by getting rid of the compulsory license and letting other models emerge that will be creative about how we license?
I will tell you that I think the person who you're referring to, and certainly the Digital Media Association, will tell you that the easiest way to solve it for them right now is a blanket license or sub-licensing.
But the problem with the blanket license is that's how do you deal with the complexities of the ultimate use of the material?
You let the copyright royalty judges set rates for the various types of uses.
Right. That will really enhance the rate at which that will really enhance the rate at which we get new uses for licenses.
It's very difficult in a world that changes this quickly. And the good news is that more and more music is being used in more and more ways.
And people that create the music ought to get paid more and more money for it.
Well,
if we can figure out how to do that.
Get paid for it as it's being used. Yes.
Right. But really, currently there are huge chunks. I'm not sure what the value of those chunks is right now, but over time that value, I think, grows, becomes dominant. But we're not getting there because of this, the rigidity of the current system we have.
I agree.
Thank you. So does that mean we should get rid of the compulsory license?
I have always been an advocate of the marketplace, and that when the marketplace has to work, it does. and systems come into play. I'm just not sure of an industry that has operated for so long in a particular fashion and their ability to transition over. However, I am aware that the predominant position of the music publishers, not the songwriters, who feel that they don't have enough bargaining power to come out well on this, is to abolish the license.
Right. I just might note that the Wall Street Journal, as of March 21st, has a headline, "Sales of Music Long in Decline Plunged Sharply."
Yes.
This is maybe at the point where we actually have to do something about it. You are always a delight, and thank you. And, Mr. Chairman, I yield back.
Thank you.
I thank the gentleman. Russia in 1993 might be a good case study in quickly getting rid of something. The gentleman from Tennessee, Mr. Cohn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Like Mr. Watt, I am new to the committee and new to much of the subject matter, but unlike Mr. Watt, I do have great deference and appreciation for the wisdom and sagacity of the chairman. I can tell he's a freshman, but rising rapidly.
I'll just sit here and bask.
Great hearing.
Help me with the difference. There's a definition of musical work, and there's a definition of sound recording.
Mm-hmm.
Help me with those, the distinction.
Okay. Musical work. There's a songwriter. There's a composer. There is somebody who basically, today probably with electronic equipment, you know, they can play the piano, they can basically capture it digitally as an audio file, or they could, as the old composer, sit down with the, you know, music note paper and sketch out the song. The song, the notes, the lyrics that may accompany them, that's the musical composition. That's the foundation that starts it all. In today's world, the way you exploit a musical composition is by getting someone to make a recording, a performer, and the fixation of the performance, the performer, the other musicians, the contributions of any sound engineers. That performance is, when it's fixed, is a sound recording. So think songwriter, music, performer, sound recording. They're two separate rights. Sound recordings came into the federal copyright system in 1972. Before that, they weren't there. Music has been there since 1831. So it's the song and then the performance. There's one song. There are many different performances of that song. Each performance can result in a separate sound recording if it's fixed in a file.
And I appreciate that. I understand where you come, where it is, the differences now. And the musical works are licensed right now by over-the-air broadcasters. Is that right? They have to pay for that, but they don't have to pay for the recordings?
No, it's the musical composition has a variety of rights. One stream is making these phono records, making CDs, MP3 files. That's the reproduction and distribution right. The probably, I will argue, more important right in today's world, where you make more of your money, is every time a musical composition is publicly performed, that means through the radio, through the television, in a some bars, I'll clarify that, some restaurants, there's a payment for that public performance. ASCAP, BMI, CSAC license public performance. They license them on a blanket basis. That works well. On the delivery services where you're authorizing downloads like Apple iTunes, it's the reproduction and distribution of phono records. You're getting downloads. You're getting a physical object. I know it's complicated.
It is complicated, but you're helping me a lot. And it's, I have a kind of suggested question, which I think it's no secret we have these, that the musical works may be licensed to be performed by over-the-air broadcasters. Sound recordings do not have the opportunity to generate any licensing income from the use of recordings in the radio. And it may be what the chairman was suggesting we not get into with the radio. But as we consider this, do you think we should consider granting a full performance right in sound recordings?
I have always supported a full performance right in sound recordings. And when the law was changed in 1995 to give them a limited sound recording performance right, I accepted it, saying, God, we broke the barrier and there's a recognition, but was very upset that it wasn't broader. If you look at a performance, one of the key things is it's performed. And if, in fact, you're not basically giving the right to control performances, you're giving them less than totally valuable rights. So, of course, I support that.
Thank you. And seeing the red lights up, and I have no longer time, I will yield the remainder of
the time. Anything I can do to help you in?
I thank the gentleman. I want to make it clear that I only suggested not getting into that issue at this hearing. I did not suggest not getting into that issue.
Next year.
The gentleman from, gentleman from Florida was here earlier, Mr. Keller.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank you for coming before us again. You heard Chris Cannon say that you're his favorite witness, but you see it's the rest of us that are sticking around. Just point that out.
So this is everyone savage their colleague week.
just teasing. From time to time, this subcommittee has received complaints about problems that music users have had in acquiring a license for subscription services, ringtones, DVDs, or other new types of products and services. And these problems seem to arise because there are always questions about how Section 115 should be applied to new technologies. As we look at Section 115 reform, are there things that we can do to minimize these kinds of disputes in the future so that new kinds of products don't get delayed by legal uncertainty?
Well, this really goes to my issue about clarifying rights. When there are there may be a right that's implicated, but the question then is which of those rights really need compensation and which of those rights might be exempt. And if you, I was suggesting earlier that if you adopted a basic principled approach, it may be easier to figure out whether new activities would be covered or not. For me, the biggest problem is, and I'll use the download situation. Today, I go into a store, if they're still around, and I buy a CD. It is very clear that what I've purchased is a CD, and the rights that had to be cleared in order to produce that CD were the reproduction and the distribution right. If today, instead, I decide to go online to Apple iTunes to get the same CD, assuming I could do that, or to get tracks from that CD, in essence, I'm going to end up with the same thing. I'm going to end up with a physical thing. This time it's going to be a digital file, so that I can listen to that in my home whenever I want to. But what's different is there's a transmission. And the question is, that transmission that is the equivalent to my walking in the store, is that a public performance for which there should be compensation? That kind of issue needs to be clarified.
Thank you. Some have asserted that Section 115 might require payment of twice the mechanical royalties if the same recording is included on one disc in two different formats, such as stereo and surround sound. Is that your view? And if so, and if the disc can't be sold for twice the price, is that something that we should be addressing?
That was one of the issues that was on the original list of things that we were told needed to be resolved. That is more a physical object issue rather than an online purchase issue. if you start going down and solving all of those problems, I think you're going to not be able to get a bill through. There's a whole bunch of issues that are like that.
You testified earlier that the reform of the digital music licensing system is the most important music issue currently before the Congress. How hopeful are you that this issue can finally be resolved this Congress? What specific steps do you think we should be taking? And then finally, do you think we should move forward despite the lack of consensus right now in the music industry on a single reform proposal?
Most people who know me know that I'm the eternal optimist. So I will say that in my typical fashion, I believe that it's achievable. Likely, I don't know. It certainly hasn't been solved in 3 years, but the focus in 3 years was to get the parties to reach consensus. So the question is, do you have the stamina to basically say, this is something we want to do and move it forward? I think it can be moved forward, but it really does take political will, and it does take this committee getting involved and deciding what they think is best. It thinks is best. The members think is best.
Well, thank you. And Mr. Chairman, you'll back the balance of my time.
I thank the gentleman, and I recognize the gentleman from Georgia, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll decline at this point from exercising my power of wit. And so I won't try to be a part-time comedian like I've heard some of the others doing today. I didn't hear that was not an insult, that was a joke.
Get us all.
It doesn't take much to exceed what's gone on before you.
You're on the Colbert Show, in fact.
Yeah, Wexler shall give you advice.
We've certainly had the declining power of wit here today.
And I'll take that as an insult. Ms. Peters, the Copyright Act has for decades defined six separate rights within copyright, including the rights of performance, reproduction, and distribution. One could read your testimony to suggest that some of these rights could be combined. For example, you suggested the right of reproduction, which may be exploited by a company in order to perform the work, need not be separately licensed and compensated, and instead, by law, it be licensed along with the performance right. Do we possibly diminish the value of each separate right by allowing them to be licensed together?
I am not in any way suggesting that we should be, at this point, combining any rights. Each right is an important right. Each right should be licensed. The question is administration. The question is the way that you go out about obtaining the necessary rights. And the point that I've made a number of occasions is that music is more difficult than other types of works because of the historic way in which it's been licensed. And it worked well in the past, but right now we're feeling the strains. And so the goal was, is there a more efficient way to accomplish getting the licenses that you need for all of the rights? And the value of the product, you look at the product as a whole, and obviously it's based on getting rights, but the value should always be the full value of what the market will bear for the product. The goal is really to simplify the getting of the rights. It is not in dealing with the value. Authors, publishers need to get full market value.
So what exactly would you propose as far as the changing the method of obtaining the rights to performance or reproduction. I assume you...
Well, actually, the performance rights today, other than the question on whether or not they may be implicated, and there's courts that are looking at some of that, though I suggested that you could take a step in clarifying that. But the performance right, assuming that you need it, is very easy to clear. The three performing rights societies give blanket licenses. They're negotiated. The issue is on the reproduction and distribution of phono records. It's on digital delivery of phono records. And the fact that we don't have the equivalent of these three performing rights societies that cover all songs and all of the rights holders.
Why hasn't the marketplace adapted to the changing times? I guess that's hard for you to answer, but has the market, apparently the marketplace, which you so, I mean, you stated, and I believe that the market responds and should respond, should have the freedom to respond to the changing realities, but apparently that has not occurred.
Well, actually, the market is responding. You know, the reality is that free got a big head start. Napster, which originally wasn't doing legal content, enabled huge unauthorized uploading.
So now we're
playing catch up. But the problem for the digital music services is, in order to compete, because free has everything, they don't have to clear anything, is they can't have like some of the songs and compete. They've got to have almost all of the songs. So the fact that you can clear, 50% of the songs or 70% of the songs, it's not good enough for them to compete. So how do we make it possible for them to, to do the things that the performing rights societies do today, which is essentially clear all rights and almost all songs?
And the ability, we just don't have the law in place to enable the agency to capture 100%.
I think the answer is yes. We don't. And that's
okay. I'll leave it there.
Right, but the time that has expired.
Thank you.
Gentleman from California, Mr. Isom.
I thank the chairman from California. It's good to see you again.
Good to see you too.
You are my favorite witness.
I'm happy. The people in front of me are doing better than the people behind me.
Now, whether this is the favorite subject of this committee is a different story.
True.
This is not the first time we've brought this up. It won't be the last.
Yeah.
But if I can use your presence here to make a characterize a point, I come from the patent side, even though I often say I have the Sonny Bono seat because I'm the non-lawyer, but the intellectual property owner on the committee. And in the patent world, it's pretty easy for us to understand that anybody who invents, including a team of 10, if you don't have a contract, all 10 have individual rights. They can all sell the invention. They can all make, use, or sell. And that's pretty cool. It's a little troublesome for a company that has 12 engineers and you have to get them all contracted or you'll lose your rights, but at least it's clear. It certainly isn't clear here. I'm sure if Sonny Bono were here today and we ask, well, how did you make sure that the guy running the mics and doing the mixing, who may have been doing it for cheap, free, or just an opportunity to tour with the band, gave his rights to you, he would have an answer, and it worked for him. But it's very clear we don't have that same level of clarity in copyright. So what I'm hearing here today, what I've heard in previous hearings, is we have a legacy problem. We have a problem we patchwork together from 1831, which, by the way, I wrote that down because that's not a date I had in my notes. From 1831, we've sort of patchworked together copyright, and we've never had the simple clarity that I believe we enjoy in patents about what you get, how you get it, how you control it. So if I follow your logic, and do I get a the straight head shake on that, that it is a legacy problem?
Yes. I don't think, but the one thing I would disagree with is it wasn't until new technologies came along. So 1831, until piano rolls, wasn't such a big deal.
Very true. And I got an opportunity to meet Herr Gutenberg the other day. We meet him regularly. He's a member of the European Union Parliament. And until his family business got going, probably people who wrote songs didn't have to worry too much about whether they got money for duplications of it, because you know, you could only handwrite it. But technology has been on a steady roll for, albeit a couple thousand years. And we are where we are, which is you've got broadcasters, if they're terrestrial, under one set of rules. You have the Internet, whether it's 802.11 and it's wireless and it's going through the air, or whether it's more conventional wired, another set of rules. You've got the question of whether or not you're caching or storing on a hard drive in that process, whether you've got a copy or you're just transmitting it. One would say that even on my computer, when I'm streaming, am I in fact recording it for a period of time, because I have to have a buffer? We can go through endlessly all that, but in limited time, if I turn it around the other way and say, if this committee sets its sights on bringing clarity, and it says, look, you have to own it, and everybody in the mix owns what they produced, until or unless they sign it away. If they sign it away exclusively under whatever contractual agreement, they've done that. If they don't sign it away exclusively but non-exclusively, then they have the right to sell what they own. Well, what they sold is now in a package. If we set those principles with, and I'll take, is that's one set of principles, and I'll ask the second question. You're comfortable with that part, that we need to make it that simple?
I think the law itself is pretty okay and simple. It's the way, what we basically say is all creators would jointly own, licensed by one, can bind the other subject to a duty to account. What is happening is the opposite. It's subject to an agreement to the contrary. There are all these agreements to the contrary.
Right. And then, and which I do appreciate that. The last part, though, is because we live in a world of compulsory licenses, don't we need to produce a uniform compulsory license act that essentially says that when you have a compulsory license, it's 9.5 cents, hypothetically, but since 9.5 cents doesn't get you to 2 cents for a cached copy, there has to be, in fact, some streamlining of that system to say, as you said, unless you otherwise do, but in a sense, isn't there a mandate that we deal with that so that you can have that flexibility of pricing? Because it's very clear today that I can sell my song to Sirius or XM, in a sense, but I may or may not be paid, or somebody can collect 2/3 of the royalty and say, go sue for the other third, and that's happening as we speak.
I guess I'm not totally clear with what my answer would be. And it really comes down to compulsory licensing per se. Our Constitution basically talks about exclusive rights, an exercise of exclusive rights. Compulsory license cuts back on that exclusivity. And in an online environment, there's a push by a lot of people to just basically mandate compulsory licensing. My personal view is that if we go that route, we lose something very valuable. It may be that that's where we end up, but I certainly don't want to be there right now, and I would rather get rid of this license than basically expand it to say there's a compulsory license that deals with all uses of everything.
Did you want to just add a final point to the time of the gentleman?
Okay, anyway.
Her time is unlimited, though, isn't it, Chairman?
But you know, you and I can sit here for the third and fourth round.
Okay.
Thank you, Chairman.
I'd like to think about it and maybe get back to you. I hadn't really thought all of that through at this point, and I think there's more nuances than I'm willing to commit to at this point.
Thank you for your candor. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The gentleman from California, Mr. Schiff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to ask you a couple of questions. First, whether you can highlight any specific concerns or comments that you have with regard to last year's SIRA legislation. In particular, do you believe that the authority to set rates for a modified Section 115 license should remain with the copyright royalty judges, or do you support the proposed structure in last year's bill that provided for private sector negotiations first, with arbitration procedures available if those failed? And the second question is, in discussing the rate-setting procedures, you indicate that it would be wise to provide the rate-setting body with the flexibility to set a schedule of rates depending on the services offered. As you know, some have argued that a per-unit rate would be difficult to utilize and would prefer a percentage of revenue option instead, and I'd love to get your thoughts on that as well.
The truth is that when you have rate setting and basically setting of terms of compulsory licenses, and you have that copyright royalty judge as the program, as the body that's going to do that, all of the licenses basically suggest that the parties negotiate, and if they can reach agreement, that that's the preferable way. So if they can reach agreement on what the rate should be, then normally that's blessed, and it's only when there's disagreement that you end up with the body setting rates. Now, certain parties.
So in effect, you have a system of arbitration already. Is that what?
Well, no. I was basically saying you actually have a system that encourages voluntary negotiation against the parties, and if they reach the rates, then that's fine. And if there are parties who haven't reached agreement, then that body sets the compulsory license rate. So a compulsory license in nature is, compulsory license is there, rates will be set by the judges, but there's always encouragement of voluntary licenses. With respect to the, I forgot, whether or not you weren't going to do a percentage of revenue or a per-
Well, yeah, but still on that first point,
yes.
Are you saying then that you prefer to have the present system than have a negotiation followed by an arbitration?
I hadn't really thought about it. I actually think that we have a new system. I think that a lot of work went into that new system, and I stand behind the fact that the system that's in place is a good one. And I hadn't really focused on that this really had an additional arbitration proceeding, so I need to think about that.
And what are your thoughts in terms of per-unit rate versus percentage of revenue option?
I think it depends on the circumstance. I think that both options should, you need to basically have flexibility to figure out what is best in, under the particular circumstances. And it's really going to come down to what the proposals are and what the evidence is and, you know, what is provided for the royalty judges to decide what they think is the fairest approach. And there is a review process in the Court of Appeals for the D.C. and D.C. Circuit, but actually this new body basically has a reconsideration provision with respect to when they basically put out rates, there's a period in which people can petition for reconsideration. So my thing is, I think that sometimes the per penny rate is the per transaction rate is the appropriate one. Sometimes a percentage of revenue, if you can clearly define what that percentage rate is going to be of.
Well, in looking at the subscription music services, though, do you have a sense of which you think is more appropriate? I mean, that's the main context in which this is implicated, isn't it?
I'm not sure, but I really do not know what is the appropriate. I haven't really considered what the evidence is or not. Thank God we're not in that business. But I have supported flexibility. I have supported it can be either a penny rate, it can be a percentage. It's really going to come down to what's the best under the circumstances, what works. It's really what works.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Abusing once again the chairman's prerogative, the question then comes, is it iTunes revenue or is it iPods revenue? But never mind.
No, that's...
The gentlelady from California, Ms. Ofgren.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. The gentleman from Ohio, Mr. Chabot.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. First of all, let me apologize for not being here earlier in the hearing. I'm the ranking member of the Small Business Committee. We have a hearing going on down there. I'm new to the subcommittee. I've been on the judiciary for 13 years now, but not the subcommittee. So I wanted to particularly thank you for coming this morning to educate us on this very important issue. As I was preparing for this hearing by reading Section 115, I couldn't help. Well, my staff read it.
All right.
I read most of it. I couldn't help but think to myself that this is a lawyer's and infringer's dream statute. There were so many exceptions and references that it's difficult to keep straight what is legal and what's not. Moreover, I had just read in yesterday's Wall Street Journal about the continued plight of the music industry with declining sales in the range of 20% from last year. So my question, and I'll keep it to just one question because I have to get back to the Small Business Committee to make sure that the Democrats aren't running amok down there. I'm just kidding. What is the role? What role has this statute played, if any, in the decline of the music industry, and how can we tighten this statute up to revitalize the music industry and push back against infringement, which has been such a scourge on the industry?
I can make an argument that when a statute is, like you said, too complex and people can't figure out what you can do and what you can't, that's the problem. But here what we're really talking about is, in order to have legitimate services functioning, they need the rights and they need all songs. And the current clearance process, even under the statutory license, doesn't work. So there is an impediment that needs to be fixed in order, at least with regard to people who want to use a statutory license that now is there, to make that workable. So there is a piece.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, I'll yield back my time in order to give Ms. Lofgren time.
The gentlelady from California, Ms. Lofgren.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I know the bells have rung for a vote, so I will be brief. I'd like to thank the chairman and a ranking member for this hearing, and I think there is broad agreement that 115 reform is important. And if you look at the headline, sales of music long in decline, fall more quickly, all the parties who have had tiffs and understandably trouble sorting this out have tremendous motivation to get this right. Agree with the chairman. He and I have talked. We don't always see eye to eye on every single item on copyright. There are issues, and reasonable people can differ on the issue of how we deal with receivers on satellite radio, you know, whether or not there should be broadcast flags. I'm sure we at some point will get into it, but I'm hopeful that we don't get into it in 115, because 115 needs to get done, and wherever people are on the whole argument about copyright, I think there is broad consensus there, and that's a piece of the good news. On cached copies, I want to associate myself with Mr. Boucher's remarks on the validity of your footnote comment. I mean, to charge separately for cached copies is kind of like, instead of paying the cab driver for the ride, you're paying for every drop of oil in the engine. It just, you know, it's an impediment to making this thing go. We need to simplify this in a way that will allow people to be paid. And diverting ourselves in that way continues an impediment. We need to simplify. We need certainty so people know who to pay and how much to pay. And we need to have an ability to control ambitions on payments so that we don't eliminate the development of new markets.
Well, Vera would have actually answered those questions. It would really have covered all activity.
I have a question. In your testimony, you admit with some candor that Section 114 or the sub-licensing solutions that you talk about have impediments to enactment. And let me just ask you this, because there are actors who have business models that have grown up around the current situation that this would impact. And none of us are hostile to those associations. They have performed an important role. Can you envision a way for the existing actors to somehow have a role in what you suggested?
I can't speak for them, but they're all...
Don't speak for them.
I know.
And you don't even have to do the details. Can you envision such a thing? And we can follow up later with the details if you can.
The truth is I'm not sure. I really am not sure. I would hope the answer was yes, but I don't have a huge amount of comfort that it's yes.
I do think that as we address the problems with the current digital music licensing situation, one of the things that we're never able to do on the committee, and that's true of me and I think every member, is that we can't really imagine the next wave of innovation. And I remember, you know, some of the other issues we did, and we're talking about websites, and none of us thought about peer-to-peer. Maybe there's somebody in a lab who was thinking about it. So I'm just wondering, do you think that we can develop principles that are less likely to impinge on the development of new technology that will still provide for compensation?
Well, first of all, sub-licensing does do that, but there are people who really are opposed to that. A blanket license, I actually do think you could get there and accomplish the same thing, too, because you get the license and you worry about more about the niceties of it later.
Mr. Chairman, my time is just about up. The bells are ringing again. Are we able to submit questions for the record?
What I was going to say, because there are more issues, rather than have a second round now, I'd like to suggest, in addition to having an important position, a great deal of experience, a great deal of expertise, you are a great educator. And I'm thinking of convening a more informal meeting with members and you just to continue a little bit of this process of understanding this complicated mess called music licensing.
Whatever
in the future, and certainly there would be a chance to submit questions, which for the record, which we hope you answer.
Oh, we will.
And unless there's a compelling desire to come back for a second round, I think I'd rather continue it on an informal basis.
Would that be kind of like the president offering his people
not
being under oath? I withdraw the question.
And with that, the hearing is now adjourned.
Thank you.